If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
I used to listen to or read interviews with actors and actresses, and they'd say, oh, no, I never look at anyone. I never watch myself, or I never interviews. Mm-hmm. And I used to think, God, that's a bit arrogant. But I really get it now. Like, once you've done something, you've done it. It's out there. Nothing that you can do can change someone's opinion, whether it's good or bad. Just don't worry about it.
Hello and welcome back to Beautiful Lives, the podcast in which I, Madeline Spencer, invite a guest to reflect on the parts of their life story where beauty rituals or products have played a role, and how what they saw in the mirror, or perceived they saw in the mirror, has had an impact. Today I'm joined by the journalist and author Sophia Money Coutts, who talks movingly and at times hilariously on a huge range of things, including class warfare and how it's affected her, posh families and their attitude towards makeup, having vitiligo, how she navigated her uni experience, her time at Tatler, harbouring a keen interest in having silky hair, Botox, breakups, and her inspirational granny. We also, of course, talk about Sophia's career and how she structured her day to allow for her to write columns and novels, and about some of the inspiration for her two books, the latest of which, What Happens Now, combines Sophia's trademark amusing observations with flashes of insight into what it might be like to be a 34-year-old woman suddenly pregnant to a virtual stranger's baby. Here's Sophia.
Hello, Sophia.
Hello.
Hi.
Welcome to the show. Oh, actually, sorry. Quickly, go on. It's Sophia, technically.
Is it? Yeah. Sorry. No, so
I don't even notice.
Sophia.
I don't even notice when people say it to me, which is why... And sometimes I get too embarrassed to correct them because I feel like I'm...
No, I'm glad you corrected me. Sorry. I just did. I just recorded an episode with Ida Field.
Oh, I saw that. That's so cool.
Yeah.
She's lovely.
Completely lovely. But she went... I said, hi, Ida. She went, yeah, it's Ida.
Ida.
And tell me how you pronounce your surname.
Money Coutts.
It's so literally money, not
money. Money, yeah, money, fine. And then Coutts, yeah.
Right, okay.
Sophia Money Coutts.
And growing up as Sophia Money Coutts in the country, where did you grow up?
I grew up in, well, all sorts of places, really. My I grew up really in West Sussex until I was 8, when my parents, very sort of very rural country, ponies, dogs, etc. Then my parents separated, and my mum moved up to the borders of Scotland, which was, again, very rural, ponies, horses, etc., and my dad moved to London. So I felt really lucky because I got the best of both worlds, really.
So did you go up to Scotland with your mum?
I went up to Scotland with my mum, sort of, it was a custody battle, and it was all quite hideous. But I ended up going up to Scotland with my mum.
How old were you?
8 when they separated, 10 when we moved to Scotland. Okay. But what happened is I only went to school in Scotland for 4 terms before then coming down to Buckinghamshire to boarding school.
Right.
So I sort of was a bit all over the place, but... I kind of love that because I, you know, I'm still very fond of the Scottish borders now, and I live in London now and love London. And boarding school was great. So,
and you had 2 siblings.
I have two full siblings.
Yeah,
A younger brother and a younger sister, Drum and Rosie. But I have 2 step siblings as well, and a half brother.
Right.
But I call them all my full siblings because I've known them all for so long, and they are all basically my full siblings. I love them all equally. So.
And your dad's a baron, and I sort of imagine that you had this upbringing that's very out of a Mitford novel. Is that fair?
I wish it was as Mitford as the Mitford novels, because I'm obsessed with all the Mitfords. Yes, no, it probably is fair. So dad is a baron, which it doesn't mean he's Baron Crispin. It's technically called Lord Latimer, and which these days I sort of tend to be sort of quite awkward about discussing because it's sort of class warfare in this country. I think it's quite alive and well and sort of embarrassing in many ways to be posh and to sound like this. So I tend to be really apologetic about it. But yeah, no, I did have a fairly, I suppose, eccentric upbringing. Mm. Sort of, you know, my mum's second husband hunted sort of foxhounds, for example. So sort of grew up very much sort of living in the country doing that, mm-hmm. like a Mitford. And yes, nice holidays and lots of siblings rolling around. Mm. So yes, and nannies and holidays and yeah.
And at the time, lucky. Were you aware that that wasn't the norm the for norm. Everyone?
I suppose, when do you become aware that you're very privileged and lucky? I don't think, this is going to make me sound terrible. I don't know if I did until I almost left boarding school when I was 18. Because then at boarding school with a lot of people, largely, who are also very privileged and go on nice holidays and whose parents have nice cars. So yeah, I think it's maybe when you get to uni, depending obviously on where you go to uni, that you suddenly are like, oh shit, actually this... Yeah, this isn't the norm, which I know makes me sound terrible, but if you don't know and you don't, you just don't realise.
It's just your experience. That's not
I guess it's me being so apologetic. Yeah.
So when you were younger, who was influencing what you thought beauty was?
So when I was younger, in sort of posh families, it's not. It's changed a bit from sort of posh teenagers and women in their 20s now, but. And 30s, but the sort of posh old school thing was women aren't supposed to wear a lot of makeup. Mm-hmm. Or if they do, they're certainly not supposed to look like they're wearing a lot of makeup. It's that sort of thing of, you know, oh, you look like a tart, like a sort of cheap tart kind of thing, which is a horrendous thing to say. But yeah, so posh women just didn't wear much makeup. My mum, also growing up in the country, you're supposed to be very ruddy-cheeked or apple-cheeked and have... dewy skin naturally and sort of
I'm thinking very Princess Diana
Princess Diana and if you have sort of very long slony hair that's unbrushed it's still supposed to look sort of quite Rapunzel-esque and sort of gorgeous hanging over one shoulder. Imagine a sort of a Jilly Cooper heroine. They would not have worn much makeup. There might have been a dab of mascara, but even that they were just supposed to be naturally very rosy and sort of lush and gorgeous. So I didn't really notice much makeup around me at all when I was little.
But when you were looking in the mirror, presumably you were thinking, do I look like that ideal?
I looked in the mirror and I just wasn't... I suppose I wasn't very conscious of...
the way you look?
Well, no, I was, because I was a sort of chubby teenager and I was really self-conscious about how I looked. But I wasn't necessarily... I suppose my obsession... was more about my body than my face.
Okay.
I got vitiligo when I was 11, 12-ish. Mm. The white patches that supposedly what Michael Jackson had all over his body. And supposedly, it's an immune disease that supposedly responds to stress. And there was always all this sort of thought that it was maybe because of my parents' divorce that it suddenly...
Is that when it started?
Yeah, exactly. It's when it started and just a bit afterwards and my eyelashes all went white. Mm. And I've got actually quite a lot on my hands, you can see, and my armpits, it's really unglamorous, are completely white.
Okay.
And actually, very personal detail, I remember I went to the same place for bikini waxes for a long time and I remember... I used to go and the woman would sort of be down there waxing me and she'd go, oh, I remember you because I have it sort of around there. So I was conscious about white patches on my face when I was younger. And
did you try to correct them at any point?
Yeah, so when I started using foundation, sort of, you know, teenage orange foundation, I would try and cover that up. Mm. But there wasn't ever, I didn't consciously ever sort of look at Marilyn Monroe or glamorous figures and think, oh, I want to have... eyes like that or lips like that. I suppose, yeah, I probably had taken it on board. I just wanted to look sort of natural.
Right, yeah.
And just not have white, great big white.
So tell me about your weight then. When did that start to become a thing?
So my dad and my dad jokes that I ate my way through the divorce and my sister starved herself because my sister was she's 4 years younger than me, but she got very, very skinny. And it sort of is a joke, but it's sort of also not. I think I was quite unhappy and food became a sort of crutch. And yeah, so I was chubby.
Were you eating meals or were you eating sugar?
I think both.
Just whatever you could get.
Everything.
Yeah.
And I remember a lot of crisps and a lot of Coca-Cola because I don't think my mum worried too much, as mums didn't in those days, It makes me sound like I'm 94, I'm not, I'm 34. but about, you know, sugar bad and fats, no etc. I mean, who the hell cares? And a lot of sweets. So yeah, I did get quite chubby when I was sort of early, like 11, 12, 13. And then really all the way through school, I considered myself a chubby... person. And
all the way through school until the age that boys became involved?
After, in fact, boys, you know, I started, I suppose, having a crush on boys or crushes on boys I mean, I say boys, there was basically one boy that was in love with my entire teenage years, because yeah. that was the only boy that I knew, because I was at a single girls' school. So, yeah, it was a thing. It was a thing even after that. It was a thing until I was sort of 20, probably, and
oh, really?
I
okay.
got into exercise. But, yeah, so I was always conscious of being sort of bigger and mm-hmm. uncomfortable with it, mm-hmm. and still in my head, and sort of considering myself a big... I would make jokes about being big the whole time.
How tall are you?
5'11".
Okay, so once you get that into your head, though, that yeah. idea of bigness, it's quite hard bigness to ever shake that off.
And ungainliness, and yeah. I was the boy in the school plays, and, oh, God, all my closest girlfriends, we had this joke about, I once lied to this boy that I had a crush on for my entire school career.
Mm.
He asked how big my feet were, and he lived in Scotland near us, and I was in love with him, and he was not remotely in love with me. But for some reason, I remember one, like, sort of Sunday lunch, he asked how big my feet were, and I lied and I said they were size 5 because I got into my head that I was a teenager at 8.
Okay.
Although I do tend to go into... I mean, people have, shoe shops have got better these days, but I do still tend to go into shoe shops, and if I like something, I say, what's the biggest size you've got?
Yeah.
And I just... and in my yearbook page, I did it all in an outline of a foot because my girlfriends just still think it was the funniest thing that I had to lie about the size of my feet. So yes, you're right. Bigness in your head becomes a thing, and I'm still quite conscious of that.
Bigness also... culturally seems to be related to masculinity.
Exactly, exactly.
So it's quite hard to feel feminine.
Feminine and sort of sexy.
I mean, maybe
and
that's
elegant.
Changing, but definitely was the case.
Yeah, I hope yeah. it is. I really hope it is. Mm. But I definitely struggled with that. And again, to be at a boarding school where, God, you know, the anorexia and the bulimia that was all around. And again, I think, so hang on, when did I leave school? 16 years ago. So I think things have obviously changed a lot in terms of care for people with eating disorders. But it was rife for moments throughout my school career, and therefore you felt sort of even bigger because
yeah.
you'd look at, it's not obviously that you were sort of jealous of the anorexic girls, but I did have moments when I was like, oh, why couldn't, you're sort of almost wishing that I could be like that,
yeah.
whereas I just didn't have the willpower, so I still have 4 pieces of toast at breakfast and 11s and tea.
Tell me then, when you were at boarding school and around your early years, so let's say, you know, 13, when most people are getting into makeup and you were not so much getting into makeup.
Yeah.
Did you have any cosmetic things that entered your life that made you feel like a woman, like perfume, like hair products, like fake tan?
Perfume would have been one of the early things. Yeah, I remember everyone went mad for CK1. We had a CK1 phase at school. That was huge. Benefit foundation, I think. That was my first ever foundation, one of those tubes. I think my stepmom might have given it to me for a birthday present.
Right.
And that was quite a big moment. I think your first foundation is a real sort of moment and you feel like a grown-up.
Don't you think it can also start quite a bad relationship with your skin, though? Because if the foundation makes you look a bit weird... then
well, it makes you look all one tone.
Yeah,
when
exactly.
actually you don't want that.
No.
And whenever I have my makeup done for shoots or anything now, it's so interesting. I watch it so carefully because if the pros, well, like you, obviously, you dab it, right? You don't put it all over in a sort of blanket.
Yeah.
I'm sure I did go around from the ages of, say, you know, 16 to 20 with a completely orange face.
And what was your skin like underneath the makeup?
It's always, I mean, apart from the vitiligo, I was really lucky. I've never really suffered with acne or spots. I have slightly dry skin. And whenever I go and have a facial, which is horrifyingly rare, they spend quite a lot of time on my nose doing extractions, which makes me cry. But
yeah,
no, I've never had sort of, it's never been too... troublesome, really, my skin.
How old were you when you thought, I'm going to be a writer?
I was probably a sort of chubby teenager. See, that's the thing, I always joke about it. I was a teenager, my grandpa was a journalist, and my
uncle... On your dad's side?
My mum's side. So I always say all my mum's side of the family, well, a lot of them were writers, are writers. My grandpa was a journalist and editor of The Telegraph, and worked at The Telegraph for sort of 70-odd years. He was there his whole career, and he wrote his last column the week he died.
Wow.
He was amazing. And then my uncle, his son, also works at Telegraph his whole career. And his two sons, my cousins, then went into journalism. So really, I kind of grew up hearing about journalism and hearing very romantic ideas about journalism. See, my grandpa was young
enough.
What
were the romantic ideas?
Well, this is so amazing. So different these days when it's all
fake
news.
Yeah.
Back then, so my grandpa was very young and worked on Fleet Street in the days when Fleet Street was all newspapers.
Yes.
And remembers, I remember him talking to me about, he was so young, that's when all the press, the newspaper press, the printing presses were on Fleet Street as well. And if you were there early enough in the morning, 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, Fleet Street apparently vibrated with the vibrating of the printing presses going for all these papers that would then be sent across the country. Isn't that an amazing idea?
Amazing.
And that just totally gets me. I love that was the industry and that's where it all happened, and now it doesn't at all.
Things sort of really coming to life.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And these stories being printed there and then being all dispatched everywhere. I do think it's a very romantic idea. And so, and I just love the sort of, you know, journalists are inherently, we're very gossipy. And so I grew up in quite a gossipy household, I think. And sort of fell in love with it. And then,
was your mum good at writing?
Yeah, my mum's an amazing writer. She is a writer, and she in fact, yeah, when I was a teenager she was writing. She does quite a lot of sort of writing about country things, and now she's quite a lot of writing about marmalade because she's a gold award winning marmalade producer.
Interesting.
So no, she's an amazing writer and has influenced me a lot. Yes. I still remember some of the sort of columns that she wrote when I was a teenager about sort of Pony Club Camp and things.
So what were you reading when you were a teenager?
Julie Cooper's such a sort of cliche, but she's amazing. Queen Jilly, so obviously Queen Jilly. I was about to say Enid Blyton, but not as a teenager. Oh, I tell you who I fell in love with as a teenager, and also I think is a big influence. Maybe slightly weird, but Bill Bryson.
Okay.
So I became obsessed with Bill Bryson as a teenager, and I got all of his books. One of my favourite books. Oh, I'm going to get the name wrong now. I think it's called Notes from a Big Island. Everyone always goes, you mean Notes from a Small Country? And right. No, I don't. It's called, I think it's Notes from a Big Country. And it was like the columns that he wrote from America, which I think he did for the Mail on Sunday magazine when I was sort of 15, 16.
Okay.
Sort of little vignettes of American life. And he's just, he's that sense of humour.
That sounds great.
It's brilliant. Yeah. And if I can't sleep, I sort of pick it up and dip into it.
Mm.
Those sort of very, that sense of humour, which is unusual, I think, for an American, that very sardonic, dry, sarcastic sense of humour is absolutely my favourite thing. So I had a huge crush. You know, most of my peers at school were in love with, like, the Backstreet Boys back then, or Leonardo DiCaprio, and really Bill Bryson was
your one. Excellent.
Him and Prince William.
He's not a traditional.
I wrote him a letter. I wrote Bill Bryson a letter, and I got one back. And actually,
what did you say in your letter?
I just said, oh, I think I said, you know, I love you, and, you know, you're amazing, and probably sprayed it with CK1.
Yeah.
I did get one
what
back.
What did he write back?
He wrote one back, and awfully, I can't remember, and I lost it, which is tragic and very uncaring of me, but I might have moved on to another crush by then.
I have this slightly with a writer called Mark Forsyth, who's written... Mm. Do you know who he... Yeah.
Exactly, I know who he is.
And his book, The Elements of Eloquence, is one of...
Is it brilliant?
One of the best things I've ever read. And I go back to it again and again. I actually always have it on my bedside table because I dip into it all the time.
Yeah.
And I put it on Twitter that, you know, I'd read it and I thought he was brilliant. And he followed me. And I now periodically, because I do a lot of tweeting about, you know, makeup. So I periodically check he's still following me, and he is. And it's one of my greatest joys in life to check that Mark Forsyth follows
so
me.
Great.
I just love him. So then you decided to do that. How did you get into
so
that?
So then I left school, went to LSE to read history, which was, I suppose, a bit of a weird... I mean, I sometimes kick myself that I didn't read English and I don't sort of reference Ulysses or Beowulf like a lot of people manage to. But I love history. I did love history.
Yeah, yeah.
And maybe everyone, all writers do that. So I went to LSE to do history on the basis I didn't get into Oxford twice.
So what, did you have your heart set on going to Oxford?
Well, I kind of did, but in a slightly arrogant way. And I look back now and I'm exactly what they absolutely didn't want. And my interviews were terrible. So it was probably much the right decision that they sent me elsewhere. And LSE is amazing.
But did it knock your confidence at all?
Yeah, I think it did a bit because I'd been at a very high achieving girls boarding school where we'd sort of never, it's that classic thing of we never failed, we'd all got straight A stars and A level and A's at A level, and I passed my driving test first time, all of those things, all of those hurdles when you're, you know, that age, so maybe a bit, but I suppose I had enough friends that weren't also also were in the same boat, so it was sort of all right.
So then was London quite a big change? Because you've been in the country, really.
I've been in the country, really. London was a bit of a weird choice. And I sometimes wonder if I could go back. I never want to say I'd take anything back in life. But this is the one thing that I might not do because I loved LSE. But I can now genuinely count the number of university friends that I have on one hand. Yeah. I also fell in love with my tutor. I went out with my tutor for 2.5 years. So
is
I
that
sort of...
legal?
I think it's legal, but it wasn't... Yeah, we had to keep it secret for the first year.
I'm thinking of Ross and that young girl.
We had to sort of keep it a secret for the first year, which is all kind of sexy and exciting on campus. And I used to walk past and... Sort of
was he actively teaching you?
He was to be fair, he was also a PhD student. So he was teaching.
Okay.
And he wasn't... I tell this when I make him sound like he was 90. He wasn't. He was sort of... 14 or 15 years older than me, but
okay.
So he was 34, 35 when I was 19. But I think now that's my age, and I think if I had a guy friend of mine who turned around and said he was going out with a 19-year-old girl, I would be a bit like...
It's really... Ooh. I've had exactly that, where at the time when I was 19, I thought, absolutely fine, so dating a 35-year-old. I'm exactly the same. And now that I'm 34, I'm like, actually...
Yeah.
Kind of odd.
Is
yeah.
that creepy?
Fine. How long were you going out with him for?
We went out for 2.5 years. So it wasn't a sort of flash in the pan thing. And the weirdest thing is, my parents, my dad and my stepmom are still really... I mean, we're still in touch and we're really good friends. Mm. My dad and my stepmom are almost better friends because they live in Spain and he's an academic, so he gets long holidays. He goes out and writes papers and things.
Wow.
In the house. He actually got married in my parents' house in Spain last year. Yeah. Which I quite love because it's, you know, it's...
I quite like that too.
It's really dysfunctional, but...
No, I love that.
If it works, and I was thrilled for him... Mm-hmm. Then great.
So did that slightly take you out of campus life even more?
So yes,
then?
So to come back to my university life I think was quite atypical. I didn't really throw myself into the student union or that sort of thing.
If I had a picture of you in front of me now, what would you have looked like at that point?
Oh my god, I joke about this. And one of my sort of five friends I had at university is a girl called Emily. And Emily and I joke, we were the two sort of boarding school girls at LSE who we wore pashminas and tracksuit bottoms. And do you remember there was a real vogue for like sparkly Indian slippers?
Yes.
There was a shop on the King's Road
from
Ad Hoc. Yeah. And they were useless because the first time you ever... They really hurt your feet.
Yeah.
B, the first time you ever wore them in rain, they were completely ruined. But we used to just...
You
even
like
in
tass,
winter,
yeah.
I remember like wandering about the streets in this outfit.
I used to have them in like 7 colours. And in the winter, go on.
So then I went to work for a sort of startup magazine called Spears Wealth Management Survey, which is sort of, do you know about it?
Yes.
Yeah. It sort of is a magazine. It's slightly a magazine about rich people for rich people, which I know makes it sound
it's
terrible.
It's owned by the bank Julius Baer, isn't it?
Is it now? Well, it's changed hands. It was then started up by a guy called William Cash, the son of the very, very, very Eurosceptic MP, Bill Cash. And it was his project. And he actually, I mean, loathsome though it sounds, he hit a moment in London when it was all sort of money before 2008. And bankers were rolling in it and there was a lot of money around and he was targeting them. So I went to work for them and through them basically got in touch with the then editor of the Evening Standard.
Right.
So when I left LSE, I had this terrifying interview because I'm like my Oxford interviews, I was so terrible at interviews. And I went and had a terrifying interview with the editor, Veronica Wadley, she was then. And I think basically because I was so cheap, I mean, I was free for three months. Mm. She sort of took pity and gave me a job as a dog's body on the features desk, which was really lucky because when I wanted to get a job in journalism, I didn't even really know enough to have thought, do I want to be a news reporter? Do I want to be...
I was just about to say, because you to know what you want to do, I think when you're younger, if you've got an aptitude for writing or, in fact, for anything, you just think, I'll be a writer or I'll be a journalist.
Exactly. You don't narrow it down.
Exactly. You don't quite think how that works in terms of actually making money and being in a role.
Yeah.
So it's quite good in a way that you fell into somewhere that you
really
could flourish.
Lucky that I would have been a totally crap news reporter because I would have been really bad at sort of, you know, hustling people for stories and doorstepping and that sort of thing. So I got an assistant job on the features desk and, sort of obviously made tea and I remember buying my wonderful, wonderful boss's tights from M&S on High Street Ken when doing all those sort of things. And then, inevitably you get sort of thrown the odd bit to write every now and then you sort of once you're in, I say to people who ask for journalist advice, once you're in somewhere, the really hard bit I think with journalism is getting in somewhere because there are some graduate trainee schemes but not that many and it's a very difficult nut to crack but once you're in then it's up to you to really like cling on and be enthusiastic and write. I mean, I remember one of my first bosses at Standard, wonderful woman called Jackie Annesley, was like, just never say no to an editor, they give you something, just get it done and write it. And
but did you ever feel that you weren't equipped to write something you were given? Or did you just research and
it was features, so it wasn't really. It was, you know, back when I started on the Evening Standard, it was sort of writing the odd bit about the odd restaurant I'd get sent to, or writing the odd bit about how expensive rent was in London for 20-something, or my love life, or it wasn't... Yeah, no, I didn't ever... There wasn't anything that was too impossible. I got... I was lucky. I got given a column... within about a year of being on the Standard because I remember there was a news story about Ritalin, you know, the ADHD drug.
Yeah.
My stepbrother takes it and he gave me a couple of pills to take when I was trying to finish off a university essay. Mm. It worked like a charm and I wrote pages and pages of
essay.
What
does it do to you?
It's got speed in it or something. It just really makes you focus and concentrate. It really, like, you will sit down and you could, I mean, this is how long ago it was. I wrote this essay by hand. I remember going to a Starbucks and writing all that by hand, page and page, like scrawlings of a madman practically on this essay.
Yeah.
But you really can't, and you look up and it's 4 hours later and you haven't noticed, you haven't got hungry, you haven't, and you do have a slight come down, that's the thing. I mean, I don't think it's very good for you, and I think that it's been
okay, you're kind of selling it to me then.
I know, yeah. Because I have sometimes thought with books when I've been really up against it, like, should I just get Harry to give me a couple of Ritalin? But I don't think you're necessarily, I don't think it's right necessarily for creative writing.
Right, okay.
It helped me with that essay, but I haven't ever taken it since. Yeah. Anyway, there was a new story about Ritalin. The editor, I remember saying in conference, there's a story about Ritalin, and I stuck my hand up and said, well, I've taken it. So I wrote a column, and then that was that, basically. So I just sort of clung on and probably wrote too much about love life and personal details, but I felt like I kind of had to do it when I was that age.
I was asking you this before we started recording, because it is a really tricky thing to write about your own life and not feel like you're selling your experiences, and yet at the same time, storytelling is what's innate when you're a journalist.
Yes, it totally is. I've actually never felt, I mean, I've written actually more recently about my love life because I had a very sad breakup last year. I never feel like I've given too much away. It's very weird. I'll sit down to write a piece and it sounds incredibly naive, but it's just me and my laptop. Mm-hmm. I sort of almost don't think that it's going to be read by other people, which is kind of sounds crazy, I guess, to people who aren't writers and aren't journalists, but you just write basically because you want to write it and you feel like you've got to write something.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com. A lot can happen in the next 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I was quite interested when I was reading up on you that your dad had said, change your name to go into journalism because you'll encounter prejudice or opinions about who you are. Mm. And you didn't.
Well, he told me before I even left school. I think he said it to me when I was about sort of 16, 17. Mm-hmm. And I probably was saying in a sort of, you know, arrogant fashion, I'm going to be a journalist. And I just sort of dismissed it because I thought, why do I need to? I suppose I didn't understand then what I might be up against. It comes back to what we were talking about earlier about the not really realizing how privileged or lucky you are. And I certainly didn't understand the connotations of my name because no one had ever really laughed at it before. And I also think that sort of class antagonism has got worse in this country in recent years. You know, you just have to look at the Tory leadership campaign, for example, to see that, and I totally understand why. You know, we're sick of Etonians being prime minister, fair enough. So I think my name, I totally see to people, really winds them up, and they would have real preconceptions about it. I'd think, oh my God, she's probably unbearable.
But if you could go back now, would you have made that change?
Yeah, really? Again, it's the second thing I said that I would change if I could go back. I think I might. I'm really proud of it and I love it, but it's a difficult one because I've stuck with it, and now I wouldn't change it because I sort of feel like I've sort of worked to try and make
you've written through it, but
there was a Guardian journalist who not so long ago said that my name made her want to die.
I saw that,
and it's just like, how is that acceptable to say about
it's
someone?
It's completely unacceptable.
And I remember really like finding that very hard and thinking, that's so mean. Like, it's
hideous. It makes me
so mean. Like, I just wouldn't ever say that about anybody else's name.
No.
So, yeah, I think I might go back. I mean, God knows what I would have chosen.
I'm kind of glad that you didn't, though, like, just because I think that actually, you work hard, you write well, you know, you're entitled to have the job you have.
I'm not as sort of unbearable and spoiled as people might think.
Do you know what I mean? It's like, it's just your name. Like, it's so unfair to make you feel crap about that. I think that's really awful.
It is just one of those prejudices. I think, you know, posh people, particularly at the moment, just, you know, the posh thing is a big deal in this country.
So I do get it.
I see it. And I try and make jokes about it the whole time because I think that's the only way you can really deal with it.
Tell me about Tatlet.
I tried not to go and work for tax. I actually turned them down for a job twice before because I just thought, I can't be called Sofia Money Goots and I can't sound like this.
But the writing in Tatler.
Yeah, but the writing in Tatler is phenomenal. And brilliant. So many brilliant writers, you know. Ed Gill, Giles Corran, lots of people started out there. Mm-hmm. And it's a real sort of training house for a lot of brilliant writers. I think Ed Gill's first ever piece that he wrote actually was about going to rehab and it was in Tatler.
Was it?
Yeah, it's a really brilliant piece. Okay. It's in. I think it might be in his book, his autobiography, Poor Me.
Yeah, which is,
I think it's in there. But yeah, it's an amazing story. So then as soon as I sort of stopped being so silly about it and went, I had the best 5 years.
Did you?
5 years. It was just, it was such a family. I was really lucky. The editor, Kate Reardon, is amazing. Mm-hmm. And the team that she sort of amassed around her, we're all still really close friends. We see each other the whole time. So what I think Kate tried to do, because I mean, Tatler in this day and age, it's a very difficult product to sell, not even sell in the physical sense on the shelves, although I think that's true, but sell in sort of people's minds. Yeah. Right? It's sort of abhorrent to a lot of people. A society magazine when it's 2019, how gross. So what Kate tried to do and we tried to do was make it funny, as funny as we could, and not exclusive. So you could read it if you were a duke and laugh, but if you weren't a duke, you could read it and laugh as well. And you felt like you were in on the joke. And it was sort of, we were all laughing together at this mad, eccentric, aristocratic world. Because I really think that's the only way that you can look at sort of high society.
But I was reading it then. I thought it was incredibly charming the way that it was told.
Yeah,
it was
hopefully. It's sort of tongue-in-cheek. It's quite a fine line to dance. And I definitely, there were some interviews I did with certain people where... Yeah. I think they felt like I was taking the piss out of them too much.
Okay.
Sort of, there's one particular, or actually two dukes that I interviewed who I got quite cross emails. I think, again, dukes have got to have a sense of humour these days. I've realised that it's not medieval England and they've got to have a sense of humour about their position and how fortunate they are. So yes, we just tried to write about that world with a sense of humour so that it didn't seem too snotty and awful.
So during that time, there's this perception of what working at a glossy magazine looks like. Did you feel the need to dress or look a certain way?
Weirdly, actually, yes. I was going to write about this recently because there was a study, I think, that came out last week saying that the sale of loungewear has gone up 20% in Britain in the past 5 years, which doesn't surprise me at all because I'm now freelance and I work from home genuinely in leggings every single day in a t-shirt. But when I was at Tatler, yes, it wasn't that we were told, we were sort of... we were kind of expected to look nice, I suppose. Right. So it was like, you know, neat hair... Heels slightly were like a thing.
But it's in Vogue House, isn't it?
It's Vogue House, which everyone always has. Yeah, Vogue House is obviously quite a glamorous place. Actually, it's sort of, once you're in there, bits of it are much less glamorous than you might imagine. but yes, so it was slightly Devil Wears Prada. Because I'm quite an untidy person, and underneath my desk, I must have amassed about sort of 14 pairs of heels that I normally run around in trainers the whole time. And so I would run around in trainers, but then come and slip on my heels. So I did go through a real heel-wearing pencil skirt, sort of silk shirt-wearing phase. Yeah. So I was definitely a bit smarter and sort of did polish up my act a little bit back then. But now I'm a total slob again.
Did you have makeup?
Yeah, again, it was sort of, I suppose, I would make more effort, sort of a bit more on the eyes maybe. And got more into, I don't know, things like... Yeah, just more detailed stuff, you know, was more careful about my eyebrows.
But it sounds like it's quite practical to you. Like, you're not... sometimes, I guess, if someone was describing where they did their eyes, they'd say, you know, and I added eyeshadow and I did this and that. But you're like, well, I put more on the eyes.
Yes, no, I suppose,
it's very practical.
I suppose, yeah, exactly. I've never been a very detailed makeup person. I think, you know, I do the same makeup probably awfully that I've done for a long time these days. I'm obsessive about skin, like I said, dry skin. And actually that leads me on to... So I had... Botox the first time when I was at Tatler because I worried. I turned 30 and suddenly panicked about the lines of my forehead and my crow's feet around my eyes. So I emailed Fran, the beauty editor, and said, Fran, I'm a bit worried.
Yeah.
What should I do? And she said, you actually don't have to worry. Here you go. This is who you go and see. The day that I went, it was the day that I was having my first date with my now ex-boyfriend. And I had little bee stings. You have for sort of 20 minutes after... having Botox, and you look like you've been attacked by a sort of horde of mosquitoes. And I remember getting an Uber to Tatler office afterwards, going to work and texting a friend of mine, Annabelle, saying, Abba, I've just had Botox, but I've got a date tonight. Am I going to look? She was like, no, don't be ridiculous. You're absolutely fine in half an hour.
Yeah.
And it was free. So I was, so I'm sort of more detailed and fussed about
skin. What do you think of the Botox, though?
Well, so it doesn't kick in for 2 weeks really, and then I loved it, and then I really loved it, because also it has hyaluronic acid in it, so it makes your skin really, well, for some people, too shiny. Okay. I really, once you've had it, you then really notice. You must notice it when you're doing makeup. You can tell who's had it. Obviously, because their face doesn't necessarily move if they've had too much, but very, very glowy. And I know I did love it, and it does make, I mean, it unquestionably makes you look, you know, younger and less wrinkly.
Mm.
But I then had it, so I had it a couple of times after that, and then at one point I had it, I had to start paying for it, which is a bit of a bummer. Mm. So I went somewhere else cheaper, and I did get, I mean, I think this can happen quite often. I bruise the outside of my eye slightly, right. And I managed to hide it from my boyfriend for about a week. I sort of kept putting my hair over. And then, but one evening when I was drying my hair, sitting on the floor in front of a mirror, he suddenly caught sight of it in the light. He's like, babe, what is that? Yeah. And I was like, it's just a little procedure. And he knew I'd had it before, because I eventually told him that I'd had it on before our first date. But he sort of kicked off and got really upset about it. He was like, but that's cosmetic. Therefore, that is something that we should discuss.
Oh.
And it sort of annoyed me. I got quite cross and fought back, because honestly, he wouldn't have even noticed, if he hadn't seen the bruise, how many men would have even noticed?
Yeah.
And actually, it's not, I don't agree that it's something, if it's something that mattered to me and was important to me. So, anyway, it wasn't, I haven't had it since, and actually we're not together, so it's not because of that. I suppose I've relaxed a little bit about aging and kind of don't want to look, I look back at photos of myself back then and I do look a bit too tight at moments, and it does look a bit shiny. And I think also, at some point, you've probably got to stop.
Mm.
You can't carry on having it forever. And then you know, you might have a worse shock when suddenly your face falls down around your ankles.
That's the reason I don't do it, because I think you're fighting a losing battle anyway. You might as well get used to your face in increments.
Yeah, I totally respect anyone who does. And I fully hold my hands up and say I did it and I loved it. And it really makes me laugh when there are certain, you know, celebrities and actresses that I've given it up and quite clearly...
They haven't. Yes.
But I just decided that I think it's probably more graceful to not do it and just not be hideously surprised when then one day suddenly things look a bit older.
Is there a time or is there a place in your life for cosmetics? And I mean in any respect, so hair, scent, makeup, skincare, where you've really thought, you've gone out somewhere and thought, I'm going to buy something mega expensive because I feel shit and I just want something nice in my life.
Oh, what is the most expensive beauty thing? I mean, haircuts always. Yeah, I remember once, so when I was working at the Mail, and we got paid quite well at the Mail, I remember once I went to, what's that salon at the top of Harvey, is it Daniel Galvin at the top of Harvey Nicks?
Yeah, Hirschesons now.
Oh, Hirschesons, sorry.
But there might have been Daniel Galvin.
But I remember, this is back in the days when I was blonde, and I remember I went and spent something like £360 on a haircut and balayage, like blonde, very blonde.
I mean,
oh my God, that amount of money. Like, it's almost immoral spending that amount of money. But hair has always slightly been I'm always obsessing about my hair in real life, in photos.
In terms of, would you like it to be different, or you?
I look at Instagram and I look at people with sort of seemingly perfect hair, and I think, oh,
whose hair do you love?
Glossier than mine. Who's do I really love? Well, the look is basically very sort of long, glossy, healthy-looking hair. I can't now think of anyone. I'm really bad at this, thinking of people. I spot. Frankly, at the moment, half the girls in Love Island have got, but and I know it's extensions. I know a lot.
But the people with the really thick,
thick, glossy, lovely hair. And actually, India Knight's written brilliantly before about extensions from. I think Hirschesons are the place that she says she gets them from, and they're amazing and they're worth it. And you have this incredibly full head of very luxuriant hair. I would love that. And actually, I have very long hair anyway, but I think it's sort of. I worry that it's dry sometimes and it's a bit broken at the ends. Mm. I just would love to have that sort of proper Disney princess hair.
Do you have a hair care, like, ritual? I want to say hair care.
No, actually, interestingly, I don't know if it's interesting to anyone else bar me. but interestingly, having left Tatler, and I did wash it every single day, because also I used to bike into Tatler and then quite often go for it. Can be a bit manic about exercise sometimes because it relates to weight and how I feel about myself. And so I would bike into Tatler, then go for a run around Hyde Park, and then be sweating disgusting. So I used to wash my hair every day.
Okay.
And going freelance, actually, that stopped. I don't know why. I suppose because I'm not biking so much and also running a bit less as well. And so I feel like...
Is that your exercise you do? You run?
I've run a bit. I do yoga. I go through phases. Do yoga, Pilates, run. My favourite thing at the moment is walking.
Okay.
I just walk as far as I can with podcast or music, or actually just with my thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
Or if I'm trying to think about a sort of a book plotline or novel sort of character, it's really, you know, walking, it's not everyone, you know, a lot of people obviously have written this before, it really helps more than, because I think running helps sometimes too, but it hurts running.
Yeah. So, yeah, walking is, there's so that walking, thing of plodding and putting
yeah, and I live near the towpath and yeah. I'm obsessed. I love, I sort of have this thing about seeing the river every day. So I was down there this morning going for a walk along the river. Mm-hmm. It just sort of sorts me out, sort of mentally, emotionally.
Yeah.
So now I've now got my hair washing down to about every 4 days, I think.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah, okay. Which it's just less.
Do you straighten it?
Yes. Yeah, unfortunately, I have to dry it and then I do have to run because otherwise it's just frizzy. That is why I think it looks sometimes a bit straw-like.
Which straighteners do you use?
The big GHDs.
Fine, okay.
Which have lasted me. Honestly, GHD, damage. I have had in my life, I bought a pair when I was at school when I was like 17.
Mm.
And I've had one, that lasted like 6-7 years and I've had one pair since.
No, I know, they're pretty amazing. They go on for ages. Yeah. If a fire alarm went off in your house.
Yes.
And you had to run outside at 5 a.m, you know, not done up, completely dishevelled, and you were... Say your entire friendship group were for some very strange reason outside.
Or somebody that I fancied.
Yeah, and someone you fancied. Would that to you feel uncomfortable?
Do you know what's so funny? My instinctive thought first was like, oh my God, what's my hair like?
Yeah.
So I worry more about my hair than my face.
Mm.
No, it wouldn't. Mm. I think also partly, I mean, I've got makeup on now. But I, because I'm freelance and I do spend a lot of time now at my kitchen table in my leggings or in my coffee shop, which mm-hmm. is 50 yards away.
Do you write I don't from your tend coffee shop?
To, yeah, I move around. I write, yeah, yeah. No, I have to.
Yeah.
Or bed. I wrote from my bed this morning. Mm-hmm. I don't tend to wear makeup that much anymore. You know, at Tatler every morning mm-hmm. because I was, you know, had a proper professional job, I put makeup on. But now I don't. So I think I've got more relaxed about mm-hmm. going out in public without makeup. But I do mind about going out in my hair looking sort of not nice.
Okay. Tell me about novel writing. When you're picturing your characters, do you see what they look like in your head? Are they living humans of flesh and
not
hair?
At first, okay. But by the end, yes. Yeah. So this is what I'm trying to do because I'm writing my third novel at the moment.
Yeah.
It's so weird. At the beginning, you sit and you just have this sort of... I always do names first mm-hmm. because that helps. So at the moment, my heroine is called Florence, my new heroine. That could change.
Mm-hmm.
And then I sort of try and build outwards from there. But no, I never instantly have a sort of fully formed picture. Right. And I never, you know, you just don't know your characters. I used to sort of hear writers talk about characters, you know, in a bit like J.K. Rowling talks about all her characters as if they're real life people. And it used to sort of, I used to think it was slightly pretentious and annoying. But I so get it now, because if you don't believe them, then who else is going to? And they are real, they are people. And so, no, now I totally get it. But you never know them at the beginning, so I have to develop what they look like. I'm a bit worried that quite often all my heroines look quite similar, which is sort of a bit like me. My two novels so far have been first person and... Well, my first one was definitely quite autobiographical. My second one is less so. But I still think... I think the imagination is a muscle. And somehow, you know, when we're kids, we write stories and we have that imagination. Mm-hmm. Somehow we lose it. And mm-hmm. then when I started trying to write my first novel, and I think this is true for a lot of writers... sort of open up your laptop or you sit there with a blank page and you think, shit, what can I write about? I'm just going to write about what I know.
Yeah.
Thus, it is quite autobiographical.
Yeah.
And then as you start, you know, I'm much better now that I've written two novels and I'm writing a third at noticing little things in daily life or overhearing snippets of conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, ooh, that could be a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that muscle in your head, that imagination muscle gets stronger, basically, the more you exercise it. Mm-hmm. And that's true, I think, with developing characters. So now, hopefully... my heroines will stop potentially looking and sounding quite like me. Yeah. So like me.
And do you have structure to your day? You said, you know, going for the walks sets you up for the morning. And do you have an end point? Because sometimes if you're writing at home...
Yeah.
When do you stop working?
You just sit in your pyjamas drinking tea all day.
Yeah.
I have to write in the morning. I'm really religious about it. Like this morning I got up at 5 a.m. and I had to write a column. But that's fine. I can write really... So I wrote a column in 1.5 hours this morning. But if I tried to do that at 4 p.m, It just wouldn't happen. And I think that's quite true for a lot of writers. So I can write sort of quite madly until about sort of 10, 11. And then I normally have to go for a walk or a run.
Mm-hmm.
And then I normally have another burst in the afternoon.
Do you cook yourself lunch?
Yeah, I tend to, or I get a sandwich from my coffee shop.
Okay.
Or have scrambled eggs. Again, I'm sort of quite basic during the day.
Yeah.
And then I might sort of go for another walk and buy supper or something in the afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
And then I could have another burst at about 6 o'clock. So, but really, the majority of my stuff has to be done in the morning.
It's quite a long day, though, so you're quite disciplined about...
Yeah, I suppose it is, but I never feel like... I mean, I suppose, like, a lot of us, we just, you know, I always feel like I could be doing more, and I should be doing more, and I should be writing thousands and thousands of words a day.
At the end of the day, are you someone who has a bath or does anything nice for yourself?
Bath obsessive.
Okay. That's a very common theme among writers who've been on the podcast.
Ah, they're all bath obsessed. Yeah, I love my bath.
Yeah.
Although, actually, I'm not allowed on at the moment because I had my appendix out last week, so my sort of dressing. Yeah, love a bath, but I absolutely have to have a bath. I'm very mad about having to have a bath or a shower immediately before I go to bed.
Right.
I hate getting to bed with, you know, like, so it's summer right at the moment. We've got bare legs. We've been walking around London all day on the tube, wandering, wandering. And also, I moisturised my legs this morning. Your legs are a bit sticky and dirty. They've got... How do people get into bed with sort of sticky legs?
If I don't have a shower, I get in and wash my feet.
Yes, feet is the other thing.
Yeah.
Sticky feet and sticky legs.
I have to wash my feet. Oh, I find it's it disgusting so weird. Getting into bed with dirty feet. Do you moisturise every time you shower?
Yes.
Your whole
body? Not whole body. I moisturise... I serum and moisturise my face obsessively. Yeah. I moisturise... No, I don't moisturise my legs in the evening because, again, I don't want to get in bed with sticky feet.
Oh, but interesting.
Or the sticky legs.
Okay.
But I try to, in the morning, so I did this morning, for instance.
What do you use?
Oh, okay, well, this is a recent discovery. Well, Weleda Skin Food, I just for face, the big, thick green tube.
Very
well, not for
hard
face,
to
very
spread
thick,
on the body.
Very hard to spread. But I discovered, it was a makeup artist who told me actually about it a couple of years ago. It's cheap, it's a tenner, and it lasts forever. It's basically like 8 hour, Elizabeth Arden 8 hour cream, but sort of more organic and cheaper. So I put it on my face sometimes with a night cream, and then you sort of stick to your pillow, like Pritt stick all night. But I discovered, I was in America a few months ago, and I found a big tub of body butter, Weleda organic skin stuff.
They've just launched it here.
Oh, have they? Amazing.
Yeah.
So I basically put that on my legs every morning, and it's amazing. Because I used to get, you know, in the winter when you're wearing tights a lot, you get what I call leg dandruff.
Yes,
you used to hitch up your tights and little puffs of little clouds of white flakes come out of your tights. It's so disgusting.
I can't bear having dry skin, so that doesn't happen to me because I'm insane about moisturising my body. But I know when I've been on holiday and you get back and your legs
scaly.
Are more dry. Yeah, I get that then.
Yeah,
no,
definitely.
Mad.
In the winter when I'm crap about shaving and perpetually very single and so don't bother really much about leg care.
Yeah.
My legs are a bit of a state, but Weleda, this body butter stuff
body
is
butter,
amazing.
Yeah.
So I use that, but it's too sticky to put on at night. So yeah, no, I bath and shower always before.
Yeah, before you get into bed, it also relaxes your muscles a bit when you've been like tense.
Yeah, even if I get home really drunk, I will
still
have a bath. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Because also, I can't bear that thing of I never go to bed with makeup on.
Right.
And because I tend to wear
good.
If I'm going out in the evening, I tend to wear big eye makeup.
Yeah.
I have to get that off. And actually, it's much easier. I hate washing my face over a basin. Because you know that thing when water trickles down your elbows and it gets all over your feet and your floor and then it's your sort of bathroom.
Yeah,
it's like
a sort of
pond.
Yeah.
It's just easy to get in the bath and just splash it all over.
So what do you wash your face with then?
At the moment, I'm not very faithful to anything. At the moment, I've got a Kiehl's face
wash.
I tell you what I love. I tell you what I love now. I can't remember. It's so good that I can't remember its name. Oh, it's not. It's that funny thing in a tub. It's like $8.99 for my chemist. It's very, a lot of makeup.
A pond?
No, it's not Pond's. It's a. It's like it almost. It sounds like Clearasil, but it's not.
Oh, I know exactly
do you know what I mean.
What you mean.
Oh my god!
It's not Cerave. It's the other one.
Yeah, it's a C, though, isn't it?
Cetaphil.
Yes, Cetaphil. Exactly. That's amazing. Not Cetaphil. And again, that was a Tatler trick. The one that the beauty editor said, "This is amazing. Lots of people use it."
Yeah, it's very.
So I use that. Or
inoffensive.
What's what's the one that you use with a muslin?
Yvelon?
No, less expensive than that.
Elemis?
No, she's...
Lizard.
So I love Lizard as well.
Yeah,
so I sort of hop between those, I would say.
Yeah. Fine, so you just like to get it off in the shower quickly.
And then it's just so much easier from the bath and you don't get puddles all over your bathroom floor.
And are you into perfume now? What would you use?
Yeah, I am quite... My ex-boyfriend was super into sort of perfume, so that was quite nice to me. And he bought me some amazing ones, so... What have I got today?
How nice of
him. I know, and he loved it as well.
Yeah.
So he was very... Well, I got a Byredo one when... I can't remember which one. It's in my bag, actually.
Do you carry your perfume around with you?
Well, only because I was seeing you, actually.
So you thought you'd bring things.
Okay, Byredo 11th Hour, which is really nice. It's very pomegranate noir. It basically smells like pomegranate noir.
Oh, yeah, it does. Oh, but it's a bit more bursting.
I love it. Yeah. That's probably,
It's lovely.
It's really nice. I tend to really love very oudy, like Tom Ford. I went through a long phase of wearing just Tom Ford Black Orchid.
Yes.
Which is incredibly overpowering. Some people hate it.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Living in Abu Dhabi and Dubai for 2 years, this oud is used by over there in everything. And I kind of love that. And a lot of people can't stand it.
Mm.
But that's what I tend to gravitate to, very strong quite overpowering sort of sense like that, which during the day I do see are a bit much sometimes, but I love them. So
yeah, you like
too bad everyone else in the lift. Sorry.
Yeah. Right. Final three questions that I'm asking everyone on the podcast.
Okay. Yes.
Do you have notes?
Yeah, well, I've got notes. I'm going to try and look. I'm such a sort of teacher's
pet. Good
girl,
get your notes out.
Just kind of look.
Like that. Right.
Okay, yes.
Number one.
Yeah.
Greatest triumph, career or personal?
Well, I've got answers to both of these. I mean, I think career-wise, it's my two books, which feel like my children, and I never thought I'd be so lucky as to have two novels published. Mm-hmm. So those, really, I'm very proud of. I mean, my second one's coming out. I'm so nervous about it, but I'm still proud.
When's it out?
Proud. 22nd of August.
Right.
And it's like sending out a sort of child into the world, and I'm quite careful about not reading
reviews.
I still haven't read any of my Amazon reviews from my first one.
Good.
And even the good ones, I mean, my publishers send me the nice bits, but I even don't really like, I sort of scan them.
Yeah.
But I just think, I used to listen to or read interviews with actors and actresses, and they'd say, oh no, I never look at anyone. I never watch myself, or I never read reviews. Mm-hmm. And I used to think, God, that's a bit arrogant. Mm. But I really get it now. Like, once you've done something, you've done it. It's out there. Just nothing that you can do can change someone's opinion, whether it's good or bad. Just don't worry about it.
Yeah.
So my books. Personally, I think this is the almost more important way. Like the past sort of 7-8 months since my breakup. It was a really sad breakup. And
how long were you together for?
Not that long, 1.5 years. But but that, I think when you're this age, it's, you know, and for a while it was going to be it. And the big relationship, and it was amazing, and he's very amazing. And then I called it off and was really, really sad for a long time. Mm-hmm. And I sometimes think it's obviously hideous for the person being dumped, but the person doing the dumping went, you know, I broke up with him for various reasons, but it wasn't that I didn't love him. It was just like sort of didn't think that it was necessarily forever, but I hadn't fallen out of love with him. I just sort of felt like I had to make that call because it was unfair on him. And so then in the past sort of 7-8 months, 9 months, I think maybe now, I you know, I went to see a therapist, and I've done a lot of reading and sort of thinking about life and listening to different podcasts. Got really into Oprah, and Eckhart Tolle did a 10-part podcast series about Eckhart Tolle's book A New Earth, which came after The Power of Now. And I'm sure a lot of people will be rolling their eyes and being like, oh god, spare us the sort of self-help stuff, but I think you know, whatever helps, right?
Yeah.
And so I got very into that, and there's a sort of quite wacky American guy called Joe Dispenza who was also helpful about sort of just positive thinking.
How are you feeling after? So are you someone who did anxiety creep in, or was it more just the classic you felt sad?
I think not anxiety, I just felt very low. I mean, I had a bad breakup before him as well, which really knocked me for six. I'm not very good with breakups, I think. Well, hopefully I'm got better. It's desperately, desperately sad, isn't it? And that person who was everything and was there and was that person that you texted a million times a day suddenly isn't. And it is like grief. And and also when you're the dumper, that thing of you hurting them, like you hurting the person.
So you've got guilt as well as grief.
I just want to cry now. Guilt. There was huge. And I still feel very guilty, and although I'm working on that. I think it's really horrible to know that you've hurt someone that you love so much and their friends and their family, and you've let down. You know, I sort of beat myself up for such a long time about that and still do. So, but I have done a lot of reading and therapy and talking and thinking about myself and how I react to things. And that, I feel like I have come on. I've sort of learnt and, just learnt a lot in the past 7 months, which I think hopefully will stand me in good stead sort of forever. So that is almost the thing that I'm proudest of ever, really. I feel like, you know, I look at a lot of girlfriends of mine, and I feel almost jealous that they've seen me. I mean, no one obviously has gone through life untroubled, but I look at friends who've sort of, you know, got married, had babies, done the whole tick, seemingly from my point of view, and I'm sure, you know, everyone has their issues. And I just sometimes in my low moments, it's like, well, it's unfair. Why do I feel like I, you know, haven't had it so easy? But I mean, I have had it very easy and I'm very lucky in many ways, but so I feel like I've got my head around a lot of stuff basically in the past.
So you've taken something really shit and done the best
Exactly, and turned it into hopefully a positive thing.
That's a really good thing to be proud about. What piece of advice would you give to your younger self?
What did I write down for this?
And what age is your younger self that you're talking to?
Oh, yeah, okay. Again, well, this comes back to slightly what we were talking about earlier. I have a slight shame that I didn't work as hard as I could have done at university because I was busy sort of being romantic and falling in love. And I suppose that goes for a lot of people.
But also, in a way, now, you kind of use that. So, to some extent, you are
like
doing
a story.
Research.
Oh, I suppose, yeah, that's true. Yeah, just work hard at university. And also, those 3 years, when you don't really, let's face it, have that much to do. Like, read more books. Just, yeah. Like, do, you know, we're all so frenetic when you get older and you have jobs and then you have children and you're running around and you don't have a spare second and you want to read more but you fall into bed and you read a page and then fall asleep. Read more books and just sort of, yeah, work. I wish I'd worked harder when
it's
I was
so
university.
Hard though, isn't it?
But you can't tell. You couldn't tell a university student that because you sound like a total wanker.
But also,
but
when
I wish
you're
I had
uni,
known that.
You're like, because I remember thinking at uni, oh, I wish I were doing more, but you don't know what to do.
No.
So it's like...
Exactly. But if I think back now, God, the thought of now going to university for 3 years and having all that, 3 years to sort of study, you know, I loved history and I still remember a lot of the stuff that I did. I did a whole unit on like India becoming independent and Nazism and stuff that I'm really genuinely interested in and the creation of Israel. And I just did, I mean, I did pay attention, but I didn't pay enough. I should have sort of read more. I'd love to now just have time just to read books on a subject that I just at the time
just you wanted to immerse
dicked around
yourself
and
in.
Didn't really. Yeah, exactly.
And if you could invite 3 people, dead or alive, to a dinner party,
yes,
who would they be and why would you invite
it's
them?
Really random collection. I tried not to be too boring with these because I think people can be really boring. Say, like, oh, Winston Churchill. So he's not one. Sorry, okay. Winston. Queen Victoria. I'm obsessed with Victorian age. I've just actually read The Doll Factory by Elizabeth McNeil.
Obsessed with the Victorian. No, I haven't read it.
Oh, okay. Well, you will love. It's a debut novel and it's unbelievable. And you can literally smell Victorian England and hear Victorian.
Oh my
England
god! Okay,
it's really
that.
Cool.
Okay.
So yeah, so I love Victorian England and Queen Victoria. Obviously
Queen
presided
Victoria,
over it all.
Yeah,
but she was such a fascinating woman.
She
you know,
was,
like,
but
like,
I think the era is more interesting.
Yeah. Quite, the era is partly, I suppose, because of my love for the era as well. Yeah. But I think. Yes,
no,
I
she's
love...
still a very interesting woman, but I think she sounds she's... quite terrifying.
She was quite, she was quite terrifying, even though she was about sort of 3 foot and a sort of little pudding of a woman. But I would still kind of like to ask her about the times and, you know, gone and hung out with her in Windsor Castle. So she'd be one. My granny is my dad's mum, she's called Anne, is one. She died when I was in my early 20s and I was very close to her and I miss her every day. And there's a lot of stuff sort of in my late 20s and 30s that I wish I could have asked her now. Her husband, my grandpa, left her for someone who was so young, his second wife, that she was a bridesmaid at their first wedding.
What?
Yeah, so it was apparently sort of scandal in the 60s or 60s, yeah, 60s.
Yeah.
But my granny, and she never remarried, she was single the rest of her life, but she was the most amazing together woman. So intelligent, and there's just so much stuff that I was relatively old when she died, so I was lucky that I knew her and was very close to her. But a lot of, you know, in more recent years, sort of love life stuff and just general life stuff that I wish I could have asked her because she was so wise. And I think when we're little, we don't necessarily appreciate our grandparents because they're sort of boring and fusty and old. And, you know, granny, I do remember dragging me around sort of museums and art exhibitions that I wasn't terribly interested in when I was little.
Yeah.
But then you get older and you sort of, I wish I had more time. So she would be one. So Queen Victoria... Granny, they might not have got on because I think they were both quite formidable women. And then this is a sort of really random one. But I have had a crush on, my brother and my sister joke about my suicidal music taste, and I love Passenger.
Okay. What do they sing?
Passenger, his famous song is Let Her Go, basically.
Okay.
Do you remember? I can't sing it.
I have to look
and
it up.
Let Her Go. Well, you will. You'd recognise it.
Okay, fine.
Radio.
I will listen to it.
Anyway, he's called Mike in real life, and he was a busker, and you'd recognise some of his. I think you recognise some of his.
Okay.
They're very sort of. I'm sure some people would slightly scoff at me saying it's sort of folksy, but he's got an amazing voice, and I've seen him live, and he's very funny live. And
you met
very,
him?
I've never met him, but I really
feel
would
like
love
a
to
massive
him
stretch because he's
him.
Not like mega famous.
No, he's not. Exactly. Yeah. I love him, and I love
I always
his
think
music.
That when I get into someone who's moderately famous, I'm like, I could actually meet.
Yeah, exactly. This could happen.
It's not Michael Jackson.
A bit like when I was a teenager, and he was world famous, obviously, but I was convinced I was going to marry Prince William.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I mean.
Could happen.
That's a bit.
And I did
harder.
See him once at a polo match, and I thought, you know, I was in. I mean, honestly.
He used to be very good looking though, at the time. I was a bit obsessed
so
with him.
Handsome, the sort of golden boy.
Yeah.
So, Passenger, Mike, he, I just because his lyrics sort of, you know, speak to me sometimes.
Do you not think that would be quite an old dinner party? Because it sounds like you'd really get on really well with Grandma and Victoria.
I could chat to him.
Fine.
Granny Victoria would just have to sort of... Victoria, she's now not even Queen Victoria.
Vicky.
Yeah, got very casual.
Yeah.
They just have to sort of, you know...
They could offer you advice, themselves. Maybe, before you...
Yeah. Exactly.
Well, that sounds great. Tells me quite a lot about you. You've got, like, two older women and then a romantic interest. Quartet. Done. Right. Thank you so much for coming on
amazing.
The show.
Thank you for having me.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.